Hey everyone, GP13 here. I'm really excited for everybody to hear this this next episode coming up. This is my interview with Ed Miller. Ed is a legend in both poker and sports betting. And in this interview, I learned a ton from him. I think y'all will learn a lot too. And that's the goal of this, right? Is we're just trying to learn as much as we can. And in that vein, I've decided I want to add these Wednesday episodes where I interview somebody from the space who I think can help us all get better. And they'll be in addition to the episodes that I drop where I kind of go over one topic in a short 20-minute time frame. These will be a little bit longer, but I also think they'll be even more valuable. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Ed. And if you wouldn't mind giving this a share, I would greatly appreciate it. Really special event in the Risk Takers podcast. Our first guest ever, someone I've looked up to a lot. And from poker, from sports betting, he wrote the book, The Logic of Sports Betting, which is widely regarded as right now, you know, the current Bible of sports betting. And he's releasing his new book, Interception, with co-author Matthew Davidow. We have Ed Miller here. Hey, Ed, how's it going?
Hey, thank you. That was quite the intro. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, as someone who myself went from poker to sports betting, I've certainly been exposed to like all of your poker books and your sports betting books. So it's really kind of you to come on and talk to me.
Awesome. Well, I'm happy to be here for sure. Cool.
Well, I thought we'd start out because my audience is kind of, I'd say they're a little bit younger, where you're working for Microsoft, right? Way back early 20s.
This is
early 20s. I know. Stay with me, right?
Yeah.
And you know, you're not thrilled with the corporate life, with the corporate job, and you stumble upon poker and you decide to kind of take that jump, which we all know is kind of scary. You know, walk me through that decision to go from your job at Microsoft to being a professional gambler.
Yeah. So the job itself kind of, I felt like, ran its course. So it wasn't like I quit the job to play poker. It was like I was leaving the job because the job was not doing it for me. And poker was actually not my original plan. Yeah, I left the job. The reason I left the job was kind of interesting. They wanted to build what I would call like the new AI language stuff. But they wanted to build it. This was a long
time. Yeah, I was going to say.
Put it into Windows Vista. This was our job. And so I was working for their search engine. So I was writing the code that did the searching. And then they got sold up all the way up to Bill Gates. Like, hey, let's basically build this like personal assistant into Windows Vista that you could just speak to with natural language or type in with natural language. And then it would figure out what you want. Like, bring me that email I sent last week to, you know, and I was like, no.
You're like, what is this AI?
They wanted it built from scratch. In 18 months, you know, from complete zero lines of code to shipped in Windows in 18 months. It was, and this was like, you know, 10 years before any of this stuff was actually, I mean, it was ambitious. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, this is a little too ambitious. I just felt like it wasn't going to happen and got frustrated. I didn't really want to work on a project that I didn't actually think was going to ship. You know, I have a personal thing with that. Like if I feel like this is not actually going to happen, I'm not happy just kind of collecting a salary and, you know, saying dum de dum de dum. I was not happy with that. So I kind of threw a fit, and then nobody listened to me because I was junior, and then I just said, well, you know, I guess I'll leave. So that was why I left. And then it just happened to be at the same time that I was learning to play poker, you know, online and live.
Did you learn on live? Oh, sorry. Did you learn online?
Yeah, I started online a little bit. I bought the books of the day, you know, the David Sklansky books and stuff.
Of course. Your co-author. And, eventually.
Yeah, well, on the first.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure. And then, I was reading those books and, yeah, I played online a little bit. I played on Ultimate Bet and Paradise Poker. Dates me.
Yeah, no, well, I played Ultimate Bet. Paradise was, I think, before my time.
Yeah, yeah. And then, I was living in the Seattle area because I work for Microsoft, and they have some live poker there. And I like live poker better. You know, I got bored with the online poker. Just clicking buttons on a screen and in a room by myself was not my thing. So
it does become pretty isolating. Yeah. The online poker grind. So then you moved to Vegas, or?
Yeah. What happened was I came down because I quit my job. And then the World Series was in April at that time.
Yeah. And oh, really?
I quit my job in March, and then the World Series was in April, and I was like, well, I ain't got nothing to do when I go to Vegas.
Yeah.
So that's what I did, and I just spent the 6 weeks or whatever of the World Series, and I had a good World Series.
Nice.
And that was the year Moneymaker won the World Series.
That
year.
Electric.
I obviously had no idea what was coming. I thought it was funny that some guy named Moneymaker was the chip leader, right? I saw that final table in person. I was sitting there. It was just this tiny room of fold-out chairs, and Phil Helmuth was sitting outside hawking his book.
Oh my god!
I mean, it was a different time. And so that was the you know, and I had a good World Series, and I was actually planning to become a high school teacher. I was like,
okay.
I was going to be a high school physics or math teacher, and I won enough that series. I was like, well, maybe I'll play poker a little more. And I just kept
kind of stuck
for a while.
It.
Yeah.
Wasn't Dewey Tomko like a kindergarten teacher or something? And
it sounds right to me.
That'll be for future when we get Dewey on. But, you kind of combined both of it, because quickly it seems like you went to teaching poker, writing books. So if you could just like...
I played full time for a few years, I would say, like 3 years. Yep. And then to be honest, I burn out on it. I mean, I just, you know, it got old and I would have quit. I would have moved on to the next thing, except poker was enormous. I mean, I was like, you know, I would have gone back to technology or I don't know what I would, or maybe I would have gone to teach high school or something, right? Yep. Like I was like 24, 25 and had my Vegas fun, and then but it was poker was so it is hard to, like, if you weren't there, it's hard to express how absolutely massive poker was at that time. And I was just like, I was like, I just can't quit this thing that's just exploded, right? I just can't, I can't move on to the next thing. Like, it's just dumb, right, to do that. So that's why and then I'd always wanted to write a book, and I was like, well, why don't I try writing a book? And and the book sold like ridiculously well because of the reason I didn't quit. Poker was just massive, and so I just kept doing that. And
Low Limit Hold'em that you wrote with
small
David
Sklansky.
Small Stakes Hold'em,
great
book. I read it.
Yeah,
amazing book.
Thank you.
How did you get paired up? How did you get in David's orbit to write the book?
I was a big poster on 2+2 forums.
Right.
That was kind of where I learned. Like after I read the David Sklansky books, I went on the 2+2 forums and I was a very active poster there and kind of learned to play poker by talking about hands and stuff on that forum. So they knew me from me being active on that forum.
I mean, 2+2 is legendary in the poker world. There really isn't another like meeting place like 2+2. Even in my generation was huge on 2+2. I need to go log in there again. But one thing I tell people now with sports betting is how important that community is to have when you're coming up. Like most of the stuff I learned from poker, I learned from people who were better than me, who took like a little bit of time to just be generous basically and like bring me in their fold and talking about it every day. And I think that's like the same thing right now for sports betting, for people who might be listening to this and have a couple, you know, friends who are doing it, or maybe have some connections to people who might be doing a little bit better, like would you say to them, what would you say to them about finding that community, and like where would you seek it out?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I mean, as we've established, I'm a little old, right? I'm 44. So
no, that's young.
Well, thank you. But you know, I'm to be honest, I'm not completely up on where, you know, people kind of, they do it on Discord, I guess. I mean, I don't use Discord that actively.
We have a Discord, Ed. You got to hop in.
Yeah, well, you see that.
Yeah, free Discord.
This is what I mean.
Chat it up.
So I wouldn't be the best person to ask where to find that these days. But yeah.
Yeah. So I don't even really know how I transferred from poker to sports betting. Yeah. It just feels natural. Like my backers started sports betting, and then all of a sudden it was just like a better opportunity. How did you make that jump? Because clearly sports betting is the focus.
So when DFS came out, I want to say DFS, the first DFS sites came out like right after there was this federal law passed, the UIEGA, right?
Terrible.
It had a specific carve out for fantasy sports. It said gambling bad except for fantasy sports. So somebody from the poker community saw that and said, "Oh, I can make fantasy sports, right?" So, and they basically invented DFS, and I feel like it was called like Fantasy Sports Live or something. I don't know.
Like Draft Street? Wasn't that?
No, this was before Draft Street.
Before Draft Street.
This was right after that got passed. And I went on the site and I was like, this is really fun. Like, this is interesting. But this game is like completely broken from a gambling perspective. Like, it's too. I guess they call it the skill gap. Like, if you're a casual player versus somebody who like is taking it seriously, like you have no shot, right?
Right.
That was my assessment. My assessment of the game was like, this is fun, but like poker has that problem too, but not as bad, right? Like to make a gambling game successful, you have to balance that. Like I think the most successful gambling games allow you to gain skill and win at them, but the gap is not so large that you just crush every time, you know,
like chess, for example. If you were like
Chinese poker, this was one.
Yeah,
except someone came out with the, I remember a pokerroom.com, again, this is, I'm dating myself,
I don't know,
pokerroom.com launched a Chinese poker for money thing, and I remember I just downloaded a PDF with Chinese poker like basic strategy, and then just went on there and just destroyed everything because there's just not enough like luck in it for quote unquote, and it's just, you know, and then everyone quit me because why would they play me if I'm just beating them every hand? So and that's that was my take on this daily fantasy game. I was like this is cool, but like it's just, I mean, if you're good at it, like I'm just gonna destroy anybody who's casual, right? So I was like, this isn't going anywhere.
Yeah, fair enough.
and then like $500 million of VC investment later into FanDuel and DraftKings, by 2015, I had thrown in the towel on my take that this was, my take on it was this is basically funded by, you know, investors. Like, I think the entire phenomenon was underwritten by the investment community. I think it's a good gambling game.
I think your take's right. Look at DraftKings and FanDuel and how much share they have of their revenue in the traditional DFS. It's tiny.
I mean, my take was this is not a good gambling game. This is not going to grow on its own. Well, it didn't have to grow on its own. It grew because it got absolutely enormous amounts of investment. Right. Anyway, by 2015, I'd given up and I'd said, okay, obviously this is gonna be a thing for a while. So I was like, well, I might as well just go win the money. So that's what I did. I that was my entry into the sports gambling stuff. I was like, well, if my take was there's a huge skill gap and this game is going with a huge skill gap, I might as well go win the money. So that's what I did. And then that was the year that I connected with Matt Davidow, my co-author,
yep,
on the book. He happened to be doing something. It turned out extremely similar with the DFS, and you know, we kind of compared skill sets and realized, you know, we would kind of make a be able to team up a little bit.
That's awesome. And now I think this is always interesting when you're kind of going into a new game, and even if you are new, whatever, you find a new edge. When you finally took the plunge into DFS, like what was your process for basically like determining this is a good enough opportunity? I'm going to put money, time into this, and you know, I really think I have not only an edge, but an edge big enough to make it worth my time. Like, how did you feel confident in your edge, even though you hadn't played much of it?
Right. So it was based on that assessment from 5 years before,
yep,
that there was a massive skill gap in this game. Right.
Yep.
So that was the first thing I said, okay, well, there's edge to be had here.
Yeah.
That was my first. And then I said, okay, well then let's try to devise a strategy. And I focused, the sports, I mean, baseball was the sport and I also have a strategy for hockey, which is similar. I mean, baseball and hockey, in yep, my opinion, the strategies were similar.
Okay.
But yeah. So, and I was like, well, what do you need to do? It's the thing that's, you know, not, a casual player, compatible is the fact that in the tournaments, you're going for variance, right?
Right.
Like you want to finish first. You only care about finishing first.
Right.
And that's not an intuitive way for anyone to think about it unless you're a gambler. Right. And this is my take. My take was, you know, if you're constructing lineups that maximize the chance of finishing first, that's an extremely counterintuitive way to build a lineup for most
yep,
people.
Yep.
So that was essentially my entire thesis. And, you know, sure enough, that thesis was correct. Very, very quickly, I realized that was very correct. And, you know, and then I came up with a strategy for I had a list of roster construction rules. And then I, you know, went quickly to, you know, lineup building with scripting and stuff. So basically,
right,
I, you know, would have a, you know, I had a little,
sure,
system that would gather all the baseball lineups of the day, gather all the salary information, and then you know, and then I had a rules based. I basically could tell my system the rules of it's like the current optimizer.
Sure,
it's like how the optimizers. Yeah. It was I wrote my own optimizer according to the Ed rules for how to build lineups, and that's what I did, and then you know. I mean, it was obvious to me I would have an edge.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And when you're building your optimizer, and this is you're doing this with Matt, or you did this before you met Matt?
No, I did this on my own, and then
gotcha,
and then I threw it to Matt.
And Matt was like, "Yeah, I'll use that."
No, he didn't use my code, but I think he liked the fact that I had the coding skills, right?
Yeah,
kind of the.
And is that kind of the breakdown of your partnership? Is that you have more modeling skills? He has a little more sports knowledge.
He doesn't code himself.
Yeah,
he's extremely good mathematically, and I mean, model design and stuff. I mean, he understands all that stuff very well. But you know, he doesn't write the code himself. So that's kind of how the partnership works. Is we kind of get together and design models, the two of us, you know, we kind of map, okay, this is how it's going to work. You know, this is the thing we're trying to account for.
Right.
This is, you know, the kind of statistical techniques we're going to use to try to, you know, hit whatever, you know, we're trying to do.
Sure.
And then basically, you know, I'll write the code. So.
Yeah. And I think what some people don't realize is there's a lot more to models than just being able to code, right? It's that whole prep of the model.
Oh, 100%. I mean, there's all these people that try to build models, and I mean, this is why I think the skill set is really rare, because I feel like you need to have an understanding of and here I'm talking about sports betting specifically, you need to have some statistical fluency. Like you need to understand, like there's a lot of like statistical biases that creep into your results if you're not careful. There's a lot of selection bias is brutal. Like the bias where you're just, you know, accidentally selecting from a biased sample, right?
Yep.
And it's so easy to make that mistake.
I've done it.
I mean, yeah, I don't like I love the sabermetric baseball community.
Yeah.
But there's something, and I'll just leave it as a teaser and I won't elaborate.
Sure.
There's something in the baseball sabermetric community that's like a basic tenet and was there. I learned about it when I first got into the sabermetric stuff, I don't know, the better part of 15 years ago. To my knowledge, it's never been updated or revised. Like it's still a tenet of, you know, sabermetric theory. And so I just kind of took it on faith. If you look at the data, it's sure there, but it's wrong.
I see.
It's a sampling bias.
Okay.
And I only figured this out because we were trying to make actual betting lines.
Yep. You had to figure
it
out.
Yeah. And the betting lines were bad.
Yeah. And
I was like, why are the betting lines bad? Yeah. And then I had to, you know, kind of go through all my assumptions. And then we were like, is this wrong? Like, this can't be wrong. And then, then we kind of looked at it closer and like, oops, it's wrong.
And it's so funny because the reason you know it's wrong is there's probably some guy not modeling who just knows it's wrong, blasting into you, and you're like,
why is this so wrong? That's exactly right, right? Like it's like somebody who just is coming at the problem from a different perspective or a different angle, and was like, you're wrong, idiot. Like, why do you have your lines there?
And you're like, and no fan graphs says.
And you have to listen to that. And this is the thing, and this is the point. This is why I think the betting is, this is why it's an interesting exercise, because when you aren't betting, when you aren't, you know, you're not actually getting feedback on your work, you know, and so, you know, a lot of these, you know, people post models, and this is, again, I have nothing against the people that build models and post them and they post the results on Twitter or, you know, all that stuff. But fundamentally there's nothing, I'm looking for the word, but there's no pushback. Like
need a counterparty.
You get people saying, oh, your model sucks or whatever, but that's not actual pushback, right?
Yeah.
Right, exactly, right? You don't get actual feedback on your model. Whereas when you're gambling, I mean, people are like, I would have bet against you. And you're like, wait a second.
Well, like,
you would have bet against me.
Now I don't.
That's
not
so bad, you know? And then, it turns out when people really want to bet against you, like you're probably wrong. Turns out, I think that's really an important experience, I think.
No, I remember the first time I built a model and it was doing well against softbooks, right? And now I'm like, oh my God, I'm a genius. So it shows value on BetCris, you know? I'm like, oh, great. Hit it.
Right.
Doesn't move. I'm like, wow, they're so stupid. Hit a different spot. And then I realized, wow, I'm just getting crushed. Like specifically where my model is telling me there's a lot of edge versus Chris. That's exactly where I'm like the most wrong.
Yep. That's exactly how it works. That is exactly how it works. When you think something and everyone else is telling you no, they're probably right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I think this is a good time to kind of shift into your new book. I want to do one logic of sports betting, just one review of that. If you could just explain synthetic hold to everybody, because I think you and Matt have now been kind of credited with the idea of synthetic hold or the wording of it. And I don't know if
I definitely came up with the words because I was trying to figure out what to call it. And I was like, this is awkward.
Exactly.
I'm kind of a word nerd. I did not like the term synthetic hold, but I went with it because I couldn't think of anything better. And now I see it. Now I see it like on Twitter and I'm like, all right, well, I did that.
Yep.
For better or worse, you know, I guess I did that. But so the idea of synthetic hold is basically where if you go to a single sports book, right? Yep. Sportsbook's going to put a hold on a market, right? So they might put a 4% hold on a market. So you might see, you know, 4% hold is roughly minus 108 on each side. So the way a sportsbook works is they say, okay, I think something's going to happen 60% of the time. Let's say they'll let you bet it at 62% and 42%, right? Yep. They'll just add 2%, right? Yep. And then convert that to the odds, right? So, so that's the hold on the market. So now what synthetic hold is the idea is, okay, but there's not just one sports book out there. There's multiple sports books. And if you can, you know, 62 and 32 is a 4% hold, but let's say somebody has 30 instead of 32, right? Well, now the best prices are 62 and 30, and that's only 2% hold,
right?
So the idea is that you can compare the best prices on each side between books, and as long as those are actually bettable prices,
right?
That's a synthetic hold is the idea.
So it's essentially the market that's available to you. So my synthetic hold could also be different than your synthetic hold.
Correct. And it could be different. Like, it depends on how much, what your betting limits are. And you know, you can bet smaller amounts with, you know, better prices. And if you want to bet bigger amounts, you get worse prices. That's also how markets work. Right.
Yep.
So, yep.
Yeah. And I think that was like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's definitely the term from Logic of Sports Betting. I think that's taken off the most.
I remember trying to figure out what to call it, and I called it that. So I every time I see it, I assume it comes from that book.
It's from that book.
maybe it was a thing, and I accidentally invented it in my own head. I don't know, but yeah.
But yeah, you wrote Logic to really kind of take us behind the scenes, I felt like, of the sports book, understand the market. I mean, you know, Interception was certainly kind of follow up, but it was to just give us the basics of how sports betting works, both from the better side and the casino side.
Logic of Sports Betting was about sports betting markets, right? Yep. That was our thing. It was like, this is a market. Because I see a lot of people don't understand. Like I said, you know, the whole point I made about you were going to bet a model, and then the market was basically not very
what you had to say. They're really happy.
Right, exactly. So that's a concept that a lot of people don't understand, right? So a lot of people don't understand that if they're betting, you know, Jets -7.5 or whatever the heck they're betting, you know, in a lot of these, there's that number is not just made by an odds maker. See, I think a lot of people have this idea that it's just some guy in a basement chomping a cigarette saying, 7.5, that's my number, right? And then they're like, I think the Vegas odds makers have it. No, that's not how that works. There's an entire market that is behind that line, right? It's not one guy with a cigar,
right?
Or something, right? It's not how that works, right?
Right.
So that was kind of the point of Logic of Sports Betting, was to explain how do the sports betting markets work? How do they create lines? You know, what is a price discovery process? You know, and if you're betting, you know, that minus Jets -7.5 or whatever, like, who are you actually betting against? And the answer is you're betting against a lot of smart people who put that number there. Right. So that's the point of Logic.
And then now your new book, I think, so I'm trying to figure out when this might be released the day after your book's released, but your new book, Interception, launches Tuesday the 17th. Yeah. You gave me an advanced copy. I ripped through it. I absolutely loved it. And
thank you.
Amazing. And Interception, I think from what I understood from the book, it was basically a way to show people how to win at sports betting without, I don't want to say without modeling, but it's more like with kind of what you got in the toolbox right now. And how to build on that? What are some angles you can look at? What are some weaknesses? Like, how would you describe
Okay.
Interception.
So logic of sports betting was really about sports betting markets, right?
Yeah.
So interception is about how a lot of the bets that are available at what I call modern sports books. So I didn't love this terminology.
Yeah,
I racked my brain. How do I make this, point with better terms?
You couldn't call them soft books.
No. I didn't want to call them soft books. I don't think soft book is
correct.
Quite the right name. Anyway, I called them modern sports books, but it's sort of what people call soft books too. And the idea is a lot of the bets on that menu are not market-based, right? So a lot of the bets, like an alternate spread. So let's say the main point spread for a football game is, -7.5 or -2.5 or whatever it is, right? Well, if you want to bet that -2.5 at -110, you're betting into a betting market number, right? But then if that sports book offers you an alternate spread on -17.5 plus 562 or whatever, right? That is not a market number. That is a number that came out of somebody's algorithm, right? And that's an extremely important distinction, because instead of betting against all the smartest people in the world who do this, you're betting against one company's computer program that made that number, right? And that's the key distinction I wanted to make. And that is true to a lesser or greater extent for all the different kind of betting markets that are on a modern sportsbook menu. So the goal of interception is A, to kind of introduce you to the product, how does that modern sportsbook come to be? Like, how, if I wanted to create one from scratch, hey, I want, Ed Miller bet, I want to launch that tomorrow. Right. How would I do it? Right. Exactly. How would I actually go about, creating that so it came into existence and was a place you could make sports bets? So that's kind of, the first part of it. And then we kind of go through the whole betting menu, single game parlays, which are, very popular, obviously in-game bets, which is, kind of where I've spent most of my, thinking over the last 6 years, right? We talk about futures a little bit.
Yep.
We kind of talk about all the different parts of a modern sportsbook menu, and we say, okay, well, how do these numbers get made? How sharp are they? People always ask me, like you said, how do I know if I'm going to DFS, right?
Yep.
How do I know? I've never done it before. How do I know I can have an edge, right?
Yep.
And I kind of said, well, I basically just identified that it would be counterintuitive for casual players and assumed there would be enough casual players to, subsidize my lunacy, right? And that is the key question. That's the key question for all of this. How do you know you have an edge? Well, the only way to know you have an edge is if you know how that number that you're betting against got made, right? You have to know what's for in sure. that number, or else you have no idea whether you have an edge.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that it's like not talked about really in the discourse, right? Especially on Twitter or whatever, because it's all, I was saying this to you right before we started recording, but it's like what we hear about sports betting. It's like when you're, Thanksgiving's coming up, right? Your favorite holiday as a gambler, when everyone asks you about being a professional gambler, and your uncle comes and tells you like, oh, on the Cowboys today, they're a favorite, but I'm going to wait till they go down a touchdown and then bet them at plus odds. Right.
Right.
And like, that's the discourse. And that person, that your uncle, is not thinking about, oh yeah, it's a pretty basic scenario when a favorite goes down a touchdown, and the sports books can model that situation relatively easily. Correct. Right.
I mean, that was my job over the last 6 years, was to come up with a number for exactly that situation and every other in game. I mean, just so your audience knows, I mean, what I've done over the last 6 years is build in-play models to make in-play lines. Also pre-game, and also, other stuff like single game parlay, but certainly over the last 6 years, the biggest focus was on trying to get good in-play lines for, you know, all the major American sports, you know, NFL, college football, NBA, whatever. And, you know, and then we started a company that sold those lines to, you know, sports books, right? So people bet our lines for years, you know, et cetera. So that's my background. And yeah, I mean, that's, I'm telling you, that's trivial to make that line.
Right.
It is not hard to make that line.
Like
after, you know, the first drive, they score a touchdown, you know, your uncle is not getting the edge on, and you're playing into a bigger hold, right? Like at least if you bet it before the game, maybe you're playing into, you know, a 4% hold. Well, the moment that game starts, what does the sportsbook do? It tax on another 2-4% hold just because it's an in-game market, right?
Yeah.
But you know, and the reason they do that is because it's much harder to make the in-game lines are not made by a market. The in-game lines are made by Ed Miller and his model, which, you know, are and the traders we hire to, you know, watch the games and to manage inputs and to gather information and all, you know, but like the lines are not made by a market the same way. The lines are made by a company like ours, you know, at running software, doing the best job we can. And obviously I worked hard for years to try to make the best lines we can, but I would never in a million years say my lines are better than market lines. Market, right? That's not a thing, right? At least it's not a thing. So, you know, but, you know, it's one thing to say, hey, what should it be after, you know, such and such scores a touchdown on the first drive? Well, that's an easy answer.
Right.
You know, that's basically basic math. If it was 4.5 before the game and then the first drive is a touchdown, like it's basically 1 + 1 = 2 to make the new line.
Right.
Whereas, you know, when you let a bunch of game go by and you're midway through the second quarter, well, now there's a bunch of information that I didn't know and that the market didn't know before the game. This is especially true in college football.
Yeah.
In college football, those pregame lines, you know, the market that bets those, the information's limited. I mean, these teams are huge. You know, they don't play very many games. Yeah. You know, they don't play against in conference, out of conference. Like, there's just not a lot of data. And so the market's doing the best job it can to make those lines pregame. But as soon as that game starts, I mean, I could tell you again, as somebody who makes in-game lines,
I mean,
we have to pay attention early and hard to what's happening in those college football games, because a lot of time it is not in line at all with what the pregame, you know, market suggested. And that's, you know, that's nobody's fault. It's just we didn't know until you just don't know until it starts happening, and then once it does start happening, you have to pay attention and react to it if you want to make good in-game money,
right? Well, because you're taking bets. I mean, that's
right,
stressful.
But the point is that's a skill, right?
Yeah, so, for sure.
So there's some, you know, again, our company is just one of many that makes in-game lines.
Right.
And you know, other companies, I'm certain, are not, in my opinion, doing as good a job of incorporating the in-game information, right? So they have their model. Their model says, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, right? Okay, it was 14.5 pregame, and now this happened, and this happened, and this happened. You know, what's the new line? And it's a math problem, but they're not actually reevaluating.
Yeah.
Hey, was that a good pregame line? In any meaningful way.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, and if you're able to do, and in some sports, it's less important. Like in NFL, it's important. Like it's still important in NFL, but it's less important. I mean, we kind of know how good the teams are, especially in the middle of the season.
Right.
You know, we're not, unless there's an injury. I mean, if the quarterback is injured, then obviously that's a major thing.
Yeah.
But like, you know, we're not changing our, you know, if the pregame market thought it was -2.5, you know, we're not going to be at 12.5.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
You know,
Without a quarterback injury.
A quarter and a half or something. Right? That's not a thing. In college football, you almost can be.
Wow.
Like, it can almost be that far off.
That's crazy. I did not know that.
Yeah. Like, the college football lines, the pregame, especially at smaller schools.
Earlier
in the season. I mean, there's pregame markets. I mean, people do the best job they can with the information available. But sometimes you watch that game and you're just like, that's just not right.
that game is
not right. And you have to know what you're looking at. You know, and this is where Matt, my partner, Matt Davidow, is just a monster at this.
I mean,
he knows football so well, and he's just so able to react to that stuff quickly in real time. You know, whereas if you're, you know, company XYZ from, you know, wherever, and you're making college football in-play lines, I mean, you know,
do you know who you're looking at? Quarterback is, you know.
Well, exactly, right? So this is what the book Interception is about.
Yeah.
The book Interception is about all these nuances about, okay, you're looking at, you know, a college football in-play line. Well, what went into that? How did that line get made? What did they have to know? Where could they have messed up? You know, et cetera. So that's what the book's about.
Yeah. I love the parts in the book about college football. The kicking was very interesting. The difference between college kicking and NFL kicking. I was like, oh, I have to now go look out for that. Because, you know, I think what you point out is, and I guess this is illustrative of like other situations you could find an edge, is if a content or product provider, content provider, basically someone who makes the lines, uses their NFL model to do college, they're going to completely miss the effects of how bad the college kickers are compared to the NFL kickers and how it would change the strategy.
That example, because it's so simple to understand, right? Like, it's just like that. There's plenty of other differences between college football and NFL, which are equally, if not more important, but they're much more subtle. And it would have taken me much longer to try to explain it in the book, where this was just dead.
Everyone's like, I've seen that.
Good, college kicker bad, right? Yeah. Like, that's just obvious, right? So, and that was, you know, I mean, if you look at these, you know, again, we're talking about, you know, you go to a modern sports book and they have a menu of props, let's say, on a college football game. And any prop that has to do with kicking, you know, that's the example from the book, like any prop that says, okay, what's the, I remember the very first one I saw that was just dreadfully wrong on this was I just looked at the, what will the outcome of the first drive be?
I
know those numbers well because we look at that when we build models, we look at the drive outcome stuff a lot, you know.
Interesting. As a
way to break the model down. And so, you know, I'm very familiar with what the drive outcome percentages should kind of look like in various situations. I was looking at someone's menu and I was like, this is on crash. And then I figured out what happened and I was like, well, that makes sense. It makes, you know, and the answer was they had field goal as like way too high a percentage for the outcome of the first drive. Would the first drive be a field goal? And it was just like absurdly high.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Why? And then I was like, oh, I get it. they have an NFL model.
Right.
And they just plugged, you know, total of 73.5 and, you know, minus 27.5 in the NFL model. Yeah. And whatever junk came out, they put it up. I mean, that's what happened, right? So, you know,
I mean, how many of your edges do you find? Because it just reminded me of this situation in golf, whereas it was something with like fairways hit. This is me and my partner. It's a similar relationship that you have with Matt. We do mostly golf, and there's a situation where there's a fairways hit prop, and I was like, "This is so wrong. It's wrong across the board." So I was like, "Oh, I know what happened. This course has 13 fairways, and they think it has 14 fairways because that's the standard thing that happens on the PGA Tour." And it was like, so everything becomes a good bet now. And I, you know, listening to you hear that, I'm like, okay, how many times when you find an edge, do you find yourself saying, oh, I know what happened, you know?
Yeah. Like, you know, the more you understand how these numbers get built, the easier it is to figure out what happened, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know anything about how the golf stuff gets made. But it's entirely possible someone has hard coded the number 14 somewhere.
Yep.
And it's just, and they just run it on every week. I mean, and there's no thought paid to it. Because if you think about it, someone has to be paying attention, right? Think about these companies that make all this stuff. Someone has to pay attention to all this stuff.
Right?
Like, we give an example in the book about hockey lines, right?
Yep.
Like, so hockey, there's, you know, forwards. The forwards get played in lines.
Yep.
The lines are pretty stable over, yep, but they get changed, right?
Yep.
Someone gets moved to a new line. Someone gets moved to the power play line. Someone gets injured. Someone, you know, so these lines get moved around. And if you want to offer the example if you want to offer player props of any kind for hockey, someone has to pay attention to that every single day. Someone
at
the content company, their job has to be pay attention to who's on what hockey lines. And like the listener might think, well, duh, it's their job, but like,
it's a lot of work.
This stuff falls through the cracks, I promise you. I mean, there's just, you know, like it's just, and some of the content companies are, we make this point in Europe, in the book, is that they're based in Europe. And so they may not understand the nuances. They may not understand that they have to pay attention to all the lines. You know, hockey, NHL is not a huge betting sport. It's like, I don't know, numbers. It's in the bottom half of the top 10 in the US, right?
Yeah.
You know, and if I'm a content company based in wherever and I'm trying to make, you know, betting lines for US sports, and, you know, hockey might be a little bit of an afterthought to begin with. And, you know, I don't know that much about hockey, and, you know, nobody told me, hey, I need to like sweat all these press conferences, like figure out who's skating on the ice with it, like pregame warm up with who,
I mean,
it may not even occur to you that you need to do that. Right. So, you know, and like you said, with the fairways, it may not even occur to you that some courses might have like one fewer fairway. Like, it just, you know, you have to have somebody at the company whose job it is to pay attention to all that stuff.
And
it's, you know, it's a huge, you know, workload, and it's just so easy for that stuff to fall through the cracks.
And I think that in logic of sports betting, you talked about the advantages you have as a bettor, and it's basically this, right? It's like, as when you're the sports book, when you're the operator, you have this massive surface area. You have to offer bets on all these things, right? And as a bettor, you get to be more of like a sniper. You just have to
wait until someone screws up.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's literally all you have to do is sit there and wait and watch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until someone like us, our company, or any of the other companies make a mistake, you know, and they're trying to do something very difficult.
Impossible.
You know, yeah. And
I think, or you have a better idea, but I think it's impossible.
Well, it's impossible to get it all right all the time. 100% impossible to do that.
Yeah.
You know, you do the best job you can, and, you know, but, you know, and honestly, I mean, as you would expect, some companies do a better job than others, and some do a better job at some sports than others, and others do a better job at some sports than others. And, you know, and there's a price. It's that, like, the other thing, but the point, and this is the reason why I went through in the book and kind of said, well, this is how a modern sports book gets built, is there's a price for integrating any of this. So, like, if you're a sports book and you want to have let's say you want to have NHL, right?
Yep.
Well, and you don't have anyone in house, you know, to this is far down the list of your, you know, priority list, right? It's, you know, but you want to have a good NHL product, so you buy it from somebody. Well, who are you going to buy the NHL product from? Are you going to buy it from the very best company in the world in NHL? Or are you going to buy it from the company that you already buy 17 other things from? Right? And the
10.
Answer, the practical, there's a real cost to going out and finding some new company to do business with that's more, you know, they call it an integration, right? There's software that has to make sure that the two companies are talking to each other correctly. That's, you know, creates, you know, a place where you can have errors, like technical errors, right? Like, you can have bugs and the connection could go down, and it just creates more, you know, surface area for a different kind of problem. Right. So, so you say, okay, well, you know, I'm just going to use their hockey. We use their, you know, whatever, 17 other things. We're going to use their hockey too. Maybe their hockey's
hockey. Yeah.
I mean, it's just not everyone's going to be the best at hockey, right? So, you know, and that's how it happens. That's how, you know, you end up with a situation where, you know, there's these lines that just aren't very strong.
And I think that speaks to the point you made in interception of the goal of these sports books. You know, we sometimes as bettors, we think it's, oh, they want to make the best lines, but it's really just to work. Like, yes, it's a miracle that they work in the first place.
These are very complicated technical apparatuses now. If you think about how slick some of these modern sports books are. You go to the website, you know, there's all the drop down menus and all the flashy things and all the, you know, and all the, you know, you know, and then some of it has video embedded in it now.
Right,
you watch the game along with it, and you could see some visualization of what's happening on the golf course or on the. Yeah. I mean, this is complicated. It's not. This is a complicated technical problem to make all this stuff work together. And then on top of that, the pricing is on its own a very difficult mathematical and technical problem.
Yeah.
And often it's just the pricing is the people that are good at the other stuff aren't necessarily also good at the pricing. It's kind of how I would put it. Yep. And kind of, you don't necessarily get both. You kind of get, you know, so that's kind of, if I had to sum it up, that would be my summary.
Yeah. And Ed, I don't know how much time you have. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I did want to talk about trading and the traders kind of on the other side, because I think my viewers might not know or think about their counterparty as much.
Right.
But I think it goes into two things, right? One is, one thing you say a lot in interception is the fastest way to get limited is to piss a trader off, right? Or to embarrass a trader. And then two, it's like, where are, you know, what are they doing? Yeah, on a data, like, what's their actual job?
What is it?
So, if you don't mind, like, telling the viewers a little bit about that role.
Yeah. So all the pricing gets made. I mean, so a modern sports book, I would say the modern sports book, the typical flow is a modern sports book will buy a pricing feed from a third party company. So if I'm, you know, Beaver Bet is my example. Beaver Bet's our example modern sports book. And Beaver Bet wants to offer hockey betting to their customers, right? So betting on the NHL. So how do they do that? Well, they contract with a third-party company. It's possible if Beaver Bet is an enormous operation, like literally one of the two or three biggest in the world, they have their own team that's in charge of creating the hockey odds themselves. But anyone else, the way they offer hockey to their customers is they contract with a company that basically sells a pricing feed for hockey odds. So that company is basically just going to send a data feed of pricing information about all the various hockey markets. And if the content company sells it, then BeaverBet will offer it. And if the content company don't sell it, BeaverBet won't offer it, right? That's basically what it is, right? So now how those pricing feeds get made is, you know, ultimately somebody's got a model somewhere that makes pricing information. And then there's kind of a game of telephone where, you know, okay, this content company publishes some prices and then this other one kind of copies, or they have their own model. And then there's some sort of averaging that goes on, like, it's whatever, but the point is, like, ultimately somebody like me or our company or someone else has a model and is making, you know, hockey prices, like your first period price, your, you know, all your alternate first period totals, all your player props, all your, you know, anything that's not just the straight money line puck line total, you know, is going to be made basically by a model that you know, is taking its best whack at what those prices should be. And then basically that company then sells that pricing model output on via this third party integration to BeaverBet, where BeaverBet lets you bet it. Well, BeaverBet, so there's traders at both types of companies, right? So there's, but let's just talk about the traders at BeaverBet. So BeaverBet's going to hire people, and their job is to watch who's betting what at BeaverBet. Their job is also to look at what other competing sports books are showing for similar lines.
Mm-hmm.
Their job is also to watch the game on mm-hmm. like on a video feed.
Yep.
And just to kind of their QA, their job is to make sure the BeaverBet doesn't hang any obvious error prices. That's their basic job.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. And so they have a lot of computer monitors in front of them. They're just, they're just watching things is essentially their job. Their job is to watch stuff and make sure that whatever odds BeaverBet is offering are reasonable compared to what other people are offering, compared to what's going on in the game. And then if they get any anomalous betting action, then the alarms go off and they say, why are people betting this? You know, all of a sudden everybody's betting second period over in this game. You know, and their job is to figure out why, you know, is it just because, is it, you know, and so they'll have to know their customers, right? So that if I'm a hockey trader at BeaverBet, I know which BeaverBet customers like to bet hockey. I get to know their betting behavior, right? People tend to kind of bet the same way, you know, and I'll actually, especially the bigger bettors, you know, I mean, if you're betting 50 cents a pop, I mean, maybe you fly under the radar, but if you're betting, you know, $300, $500, whatever at a time on hockey, there's going to be some employee, some trader at BeaverBet who knows who you are.
Yeah.
They may not know you by name, but they'll know you by customer number or some tag, right? And they'll know, they'll get to know your betting behavior. And they'll also begin to have an opinion about whether you're winning on your betting or you're not winning on your bet based on your betting behavior. And so the types of betting behavior that can get you in. So in the book, we say, if you want to continue to be able to bet, you know, because the trader's all other job is if they see customers that they think are beating BeaverBet, their job is to turn those customers off.
Right.
To say no more betting hockey for you. That's their job.
Yes.
So what's going to piss a trader off? Well, if you rush to information within 2 seconds, right?
Yeah.
So like, let's say an injury is announced, and every time an injury is announced on Twitter, within 10 seconds, you're jamming in bets against his team at BeaverBet. The trader's going to notice after you do that a couple times, especially if you do it for any kind of money. And I mean, who wants to deal with, I mean, if it's your job to protect BeaverBet, do you want to deal with that?
No.
I mean, that would be annoying, right?
Look, you know, I have my, I sit on one side of the counter, but I certainly empathize with certain.
You understand why they would be like, enough of you.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Right? Because they're going to get yelled at, right? Like,
it's their job to protect the book. I mean, it's their job to protect the book. And one of the only tools they're given to protect the book is to factor customers.
Yeah.
They're basically told, hey, if you want to protect us, the thing you can do is take a customer and make it so that they can only bet, you know, 1/100th of what they could bet before. That's your tool. Well, I mean, you're given one tool to do your job. The other thing they can do usually is they could tweak the odds. So they could, you know, and they might do that. That's another thing traders can do, if they could say, okay, you know, I think -210 is a bad price. I'm going to make it -220, -230. That's another thing they could do. But yeah, I mean, a lot of what the traders role is to profile the customers and monitor the, you know, their sports and stuff.
And a lot of my followers are in the DFS pick'em space, Prize Picks, Underdog. I know you got asked about that. I was listening to one of the podcasts you did on the book. I forget one, but essentially, but you know, not to get too deep into what it is, it's just parlays and whatnot, but they're starting to limit, and the people who are in my Discord or whatever, who I'm connecting with, who are just into this now, they're getting limited. And as you know, like, you feel like this sense of injustice, right? When it originally happens, but there's not, I've been limited a lot, and like you kind of come to accept it, but is there a way, like if you're not betting obvious error lines and if you're not chasing steam and if you're not being first to act on Twitter news on them, do they have some sort of utility for someone who's just better than them at a sport? And will they give you a rope? Like I know that I'll speak up for Caesars right now, who's given me a bit of rope on golf. But like, you know, yeah, that would be my question. Like, does that actually exist, or is that kind of a fairy tale?
So I want to be a little careful about how I answer this, because I'm.
Yeah, sure. You don't have to name names or whatever.
I'm going to talk very generally about.
Okay.
But yes, 100%. If you are subtle about it,
yeah,
about how you're beating, and it's again, it's mostly the large. I make the distinction in interception between, you know, I say if there's, let's say you're in a state that has 20 sportsbooks operating, right?
Yeah,
the sportsbooks are going to follow the 80-20 rule.
Yeah,
80% of the betting action happens at 20% of the books. So there's going to be a top four and mm-hmm. a bottom 16 as far as market share from the books. So, and I'm not going to name names, but you know who they
are.
We
know. We all know. Right? You all know. Okay. Right?
So if you're in a bottom 16, all bets are up, because they're not there to gamble at all. They're in business for other reasons. And we talk about that in the book a little bit.
Very interesting. You know,
some of them are up and coming, but you can't expect to have any rope with any of those companies, because it's just not in their interest. Like it's just, they just can't afford to lose to bettors. Like it's just not in their business plan, like at all.
Yeah, no.
The top four, the big ones, where their business is taking bets and trying to win on the bets, absolutely, if you are subtle about it and you aren't doing things that are where it's obvious how you're winning and so forth, and especially if you make, you know, what I would call cover plays, where you're betting things that kind of look square, you know, they kind of, they're very similar to the types of bets that, you know, square people make. And again, yes, 100% you can have substantially more rope. Now, I just said a mouthful, because it is very difficult to look square and not actually be square. That is a huge, and that's a point I make in the book, is that that's maybe the biggest sports betting skill of all. Like if I think of what I'm aware of as far as who's been successful and who's made what and, you know, blah blah blah, like, and I think of like, well, how did they actually achieve it? I think one of the core skills is being able to make bets that look like square action, but that are like break even-ish.
You know, yeah.
Where you're playing into something, it looks like you're just giving them their 4% hold. You're playing into a market number. It looks like there's really no way you could be not losing on this stuff. And yet you're able to pick it well enough that you aren't really losing on it. That's a huge skill, because if you can do that, then you can hide a few good bets in there.
Trojan horse
among all the noise.
Yeah.
And you can get, you know, a consistently positive percentage on potentially extremely large betting volumes. And that's how this works. It is not easy. And there's a reason why you don't hear about it much. It's because, you know, there's just not many people who can do it, really. But
I would pay a lot of money for just the API of like negative 0.5% bets on like major markets coming to me. I would do anything for that.
People don't think about this, right? But if you can pick, right, like your average, you know, betting into the market the morning of the game bet is, you know, minus 4%, right?
Right.
4% hold on the market, right?
Yeah.
So if you can systematically get that edge down to like minus half a percent.
Yep.
That's extremely valuable.
Oh my God.
Also an extreme skill. It is not trivial at all.
No. Either. I don't want to make it seem trivial.
But yeah. Like that is a very valuable skill to be able to do. People might think, oh, but you're still losing. Yes. But you know, and we elaborate in the book exactly why that's so valuable. But yeah, so
I mean, those plays are more valuable than. Look, I love Establish the Run and Unabated and all of them, but honestly, like, if you're gonna just tail a popular tout that's winning for sure, you're gonna get limited a lot.
Yep.
If you tail, if there's a tout out there who's giving out negative 0.5% bets, like, talk to me if you're out there listening, like.
Right.
Those are the plays I really want.
Right. Now exactly. And this is counter. This is why I wrote the book, because it's like you once I say it in the book, you're like, oh, that makes sense. But like it needs, like, most people wouldn't come up with that on their own. Right. So I just think that's like an interesting tidbit about how gambling works to kind of teach people. So.
It's that stuff that isn't the modeling, that isn't necessarily even the trading. Like, it's just that your book is going to
I think it's always the trading. The discourse on Twitter is always like, oh, I win at 79% or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just I have to laugh, because obviously those numbers are meaningless and nonsense to begin with, and often just completely made up.
Yeah.
But B, like, that's not what you actually want it to look like. You don't want it to
look
like that at all. You know, and so it's just funny to me that it's just such an ignorant, you know, thing, but it's just obviously it's the most obvious thing. Like, that's what people think. The more winning, the better. That's what I want to do. Is I want to win at the higher the percentage of picks, the better. Well, that's not how this works.
Lose a lot. No, that chapter of the book, I read it. I was like, man, because that's one thing we really try and do: deposit a lot, take huge high variance spots. Like, that's given us a lot of longevity, and I think you just nailed it with that. But it's, you know what, like, it's hard to stomach that. It's hard to put yourself in the mindset where you're like, I really want to redeposit. Like, that's pretty good. And if I don't,
for sure. And and to be clear, I found a little bit, like, I want to be clear, like, I don't expect most people who read the book to actually go out and do this. I feel like a lot of the book is honestly largely for entertainment. It's like, here's you want to learn how it works, here's how it works, right like, it's not a how-to guide to how to go out and do that, really. It's more, this is how it works, and if you want to learn more, go do your own research. It's kind of the attitude.
We're a little over time. I don't want to take any more of your time, but I really have to stress to everybody how amazing this book is. And, you know, you just, there's no reason you shouldn't get it. It's, you know, Ed and Matt, they wrote such a good book with logic. You should get this book. It's just so unique in how it breaks down sports betting, edges, angles, viewpoints. It's just like nothing I've ever seen. And it's the actual stuff that's going to make you money. And as somebody who bets and does this as my sole source of income, this is the exact stuff I think about. So I appreciate you and Matt for writing this stuff and to create a discourse beyond just, oh, I win 80% of my picks, you know, the Bears don't do good against the run or something. You know, it's so refreshing to see, because I eat this stuff up. I'd love to have you back to do even more in depth sometime later. Like, I've enjoyed this conversation. I just appreciate you taking the time for me and my audience.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it. Just to be clear, the book's out Tuesday the 17th. It's called Interception, The Secrets of Modern Sports Betting, and you'll be able to get it on Amazon. So you could search for my name, Ed Miller, or you could search for Interception, Ed Miller, or whatever, and you should find it on Amazon.
Yeah. And I'll link it in the show notes. I'll blast it over Twitter. I will make sure you all have the link to this, put in the Discord and whatever. And I hope you learn something, and I hope we can convince Ed to come back on.
I would be delighted. Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. Thank you, Ed. All right. Well, if you made it this far, thank you. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Ed. I know I did. And if I have, you know, if I have one ask, it would be to share this episode and this episode specifically. Not only will it, you know, get the word out on the podcast, but we want to spread the word on Ed's book and push it to the even further up the top of the Amazon charts. You know, it's in sports betting now. Let's push it up to the top of nonfiction, you know, or, you know, whatever. So yeah, if you could really share this with a couple of your friends, it'll help them. They'll make more money and we'll also support Ed and grow the podcast at the same time. Sounds like a win-win-win.